Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
This is a special podcast extra edition of On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Usually our show first airs live, but sometimes we get to record it. And sometimes those recorded interviews are so interesting, so full of stories and insights that we simply can't fit it all into our regular radio broadcast. That's what happened this week when we spoke with retired Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Larry Wilkerson served in the U.S. Army for 31 years. And for more than 10 years after that, he was the man who stood at Colin Powell's side. Wilkerson served both as Powell's special assistant at the Joint Chiefs and then as chief of staff for Powell when he was Secretary of State. As you know, Colin Powell died on Monday, October 18th. He was 84 years old, and he is one of the most consequential figures in late 20th century American history. We wanted to observe Powell's legacy through the eyes of the people who not only knew him best, but spent the most time with him during some of the most important moments in Powell's career. Well, no one comes closer to that than Larry Wilkerson. He was at Powell's side during some of his greatest achievements as Secretary of State, particularly with diplomatic relations with China. And he was there at Powell's self-admitted lowest moment, the 2003 speech he gave at the United Nations, justifying the U.S.'s desire to invade Iraq. Larry Wilkerson, in fact, knows so much about Colin Powell that he received hundreds of interview requests from various media after Powell's death. He said no to all of them, except one. So in this podcast special, you will hear our entire unedited conversation with Larry Wilkerson, his one-of-a-kind stories about the late Secretary of State, and his breathtaking insights on Colin Powell's decision-making and character at pivotal moments in U.S. history, particularly between 2002 to 2005. Colonel Wilkerson, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
I'm very sorry that you're back with us on this occasion, because I know how close you and Secretary Powell were for so many years, so this cannot be an easy moment for you. But why don't you tell me the story, if you could, about the first time you met Colin Powell?
Let me say first, if I may, Meghna, that this was not unexpected, of course. He was 84 years old and battling a number of physical problems. But it is a blow to the nation, I think. We've lost a great man, a fundamentally good and great man. And that's always a sad thing, particularly when on the horizon one sees no such men or women today. At least that's my view. And that's a sad commentary, too. I first met him, oddly enough, when I was ensconced at the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, Rhode Island, on the faculty, and a personal assistant, really, to the Navy Admiral, who was the president of the college, because I was the only person on the faculty who had had, quote, joint, unquote, experience. That is, I'd served with the other services for a considerable period of time. And we were revamping the curriculum to make it joint. And the Admiral called me down one day and he said, "You've got a call on the secure phone there. Take it." I was used to being called to his office for other things. And I said, "Who is it?" He said, "Pick it up." And I picked it up, and it was Colin Powell, the National Security Advisor to Ronald Reagan, whom I didn't know other than I had received a phone call from him one time before when I was executive assistant to another admiral out in the Pacific. He was deputy national security advisor at that time. And he said, "I want you to come down to Washington and interview with me." I said, "For what, sir?" He said, "I want you to be my speechwriter, maybe." So long story short, I flew to Washington, met with him, and that was one heck of a meeting for about 2 hours in a dark, dank room in the E-ring of the Pentagon, which is where they put people who are waiting assignment. And it started a relationship that lasted directly for 12 years, directly working for him, and more than a quarter of a century knowing him.
Hmm. So can you tell us a little bit more about that man that you met that first time in that dark, dank room? You, obviously, as you said, you'd heard of him, but what kind of man did you see?
It was a fascinating interview. Here we are in this dungeon in the Pentagon. He's a three-star general getting ready to pin on a four-star. I knew where he'd been in the White House. And he's with me and one other person in this room, and that's it. No one, no aides, no assistants, nothing, just a secretary. And for 2 hours, we interviewed, and he asked me such telling questions as, can you write a speech for a Black Baptist church? It's all seriousness. And then he smiled that broad grin of his, and he said, I can do that. Don't worry. To the point where he asked me toward the end of a 2 hour or so interview, do you want the job? And I said, no, without even thinking about it, really. I said, no. And then I had to think about it because he came forward in his seat, looked at me and said, why? And I said, because I'm very happy where I am. The interview terminated shortly thereafter, and I went back to Newport thinking I'd never hear from him. And when I did, I was amazed because he wanted me to take the job. Later, almost a year later, working for him, he would tell me that one of the reasons he hired me was because he did not want any lean and hungry look Cassius around him. Mm. He didn't want ambitious people around him who were more interested in their own career than his. And so that's one of the reasons he hired me, was I said I didn't want the job.
Wow. So what does that tell you about the kind of leader he was?
It gave me an extraordinary insight into him, which I gained even more so in just the first several weeks working for him in Atlanta, Georgia, at the U.S. Forces Command at the time. He was in charge of it. He was in charge of all the military army forces within the continental United States and Virgin Islands and other territories. And I learned, first of all, that I could say almost anything to him as long as I was logical, as long as I was sincere and honest. I could tell him, for example, when he said Ronald Reagan wanted the military to be more involved in the drug war, and H.W. Bush was the same way. I could tell him, General, why would we want to join a war we can't win? And he would look back at me with a perplexed expression on his face. And what do you mean? And I would say, I said, we can't win that war, General. It's like the war on poverty. There will always be poverty. There will always be drugs. So why would the military want to contaminate itself in a struggle that it can't possibly win? Oh, well, he said, that's all well and good. And I knew at that moment he agreed with me in logical terms, real terms. But he knew the president wanted the military involved in the drug war, and he was damn well going to have to do that. That was Colin Powell.
I see. You know, I never had the chance, the opportunity to interview Secretary Powell. And he's one of those figures in American history who I desperately want to understand more, right? Because on paper, if you look at sort of the circumstances of life into which he was born, right? It's not exactly the suite of things that you would say, well, this is a person who's going to go on to become one of the most influential Americans in the 20th century, for sure, right? Like, he kind of had the cards stacked against him as being born, you know, born Black in the United States. So what was it about him that you saw, observed, worked with, and learned over that decade plus that you worked with him that helped you understand, like, how did he become the Colin Powell that we all later saw on the world stage?
Well, you put your finger on the essence of Colin Powell, really, whether you call it a Horatio Alger story or whatever, the American dream come true. He did name his book that, My American Journey. And you also put your finger on his dilemma of character, if you will. Here's a man who in the old republic understood that honesty, decency, caring for your subordinates, caring for others in general, but especially for your subordinates and for those less privileged than you, loyalty and all the things that the old republic, the old American republic, rewarded, or in its dream of itself, thought it rewarded. And he said, if you work hard and you're honest and decent and you care for other people and especially those beneath you, you'll progress. It's the American dream. It will happen. And if you have energy and adroitness and skill and talent and brains, you'll go even faster. And indeed, the old republic, the old America was alive still enough for it to push him up. And all the more consequential because blackness is an impediment to that in even the old republic, certainly still so today. And yet he made it. And you have to understand that about him, I think, to understand. You know, I was recently looking at reading Jean Le Carré's latest and final book, Silverview, and the cover flap has a sentence on it that is telling. The sentence, in essence, says something to the effect of, how can you be patriotic in a country you no longer recognize? Colin Powell came, especially on 6 January, with the events at the Capitol, at the U.S. Capitol, to realize that the validity of that statement. How can you be patriotic to a country you no longer recognize? Well, that country put Colin Powell, allowed Colin Powell to use his personal abilities, his character, his standards, his honesty, his decency, to get where he got to arguably the highest position of power in the most powerful country in the world, militarily, and then the second, I think, most powerful position in that country as Secretary of State. And so how do you look back on that and not have some tremendous regrets when you see that country no longer recognizable? And frankly, I would say in that sense, I'm happy that he passed because he didn't need to see any more than that.
Oh, Colonel Wilkerson, that's hard to hear, I'll be honest. Hard possibly because of its truth. But I presume you talked with Secretary Powell after January 6th. I mean, did he tell you directly that of that heartbreak that you're describing?
I don't think we could have talked about it. I really don't.
Oh, okay.
We didn't. I'm basing this on words I heard from others who were still around him in an administrative sense, and also a couple of public remarks that he made. Mm-hmm. I can look in his face when he's on television and when he says something like he never thought anything like that would happen. It takes me right back to the conversations we had about the civil-military relationship. We would wax eloquent, if you will, to one another in private spaces. And he would say things like, it could never happen in America. It could never happen in America that the military would pull off a coup d'etat or whatever. And I would look at him and I would say, history speaks differently, General. History says every country that becomes the world's hegemon, whether it's Rome or Britain, eventually produces a situation where the circumstances are pregnant for that sort of thing to happen. It can happen in any number of ways, and we would go over them. And he would conclude at the end of the conversation almost with a tossing of me into the garbage heap, you know, go away, Larry. Or LW, he called me LW all the time. He liked to call people by their initials. Go away. We've had enough of this conversation. And I think there again, there was a realization inside him that what I was saying at least was historically true, if not relevant at the moment. And I would agree with him that we had a civil-military relationship that was such that it didn't look like it could happen anytime soon, but I would always follow up with, be careful. It can happen. And I'll give you another example of this. When we were talking about the drug war and the U.S. military entering it, I went forward to my time at the Marine Corps War College when I took a seminar of Marines and soldiers, airmen and sailors down to see the admiral at the Atlantic Command who had really assumed much of this war. And after he had given us this brilliant briefing on how the war was going, one of my Marines held his hand up and said, "Admiral, can I speak?" And the Admiral, really a pretty good gentleman, said, "Certainly, Marine." And the Marine said, "Well, you're J2, your intelligence officer, and you just told us that you're attacking the lines of communication where the drugs flow out of the Atlantic and Caribbean, and now you're attacking in the Pacific, and that you at best have attrited that flow by 8 or 9%. Why are you attacking those lines of communication when any good war theorist knows that the center of gravity of the drug war is not those lines of communication, those flows of drugs? It's the people sucking down the drugs in Europe and America. So why aren't you putting the money and efforts, why isn't the nation putting the money and efforts towards rehabilitation, towards getting people off these drugs, rather than going after some poor campesino in Colombia or some poor farmer in Afghanistan?" The Admiral, frankly, didn't have an answer. Well, Powell and I had that conversation again subsequently in a more private moment, and there was no answer. The only answer is it's politically expedient to use the military in a war that can't be won, and furthermore, to use it in a way that is counterproductive, not successful.
Well, so how did Colin Powell feel about that when you were having those conversations? Because that is ideally not the way the nation ought to use the military.
You're absolutely right. And he knew that. He knew that in his heart of heart, in his soul of souls. He knew that. But you have to do the things you have to do to ascend that ladder, even the old republic's ladder, where you tell yourself that honesty, decency, integrity, and so forth is what's propelling you along. You know, in that little dark part of your mind that visits you at 2 a.m. in the morning when you can't sleep, that you have to make a lot of compromises too. You have to go along to get along, as we used to say in the military. And while Colin Powell did that less than anyone I've ever worked for, that is to say, he tried his best to forge the best path, not the accommodating path. He did accommodate from time to time. And the most egregious example of that, of course, was the presentation at the United Nations.
I do want to ask you about that, but we're going to put that to one side for a moment here, because I still want to learn from you by your direct experience with him for, again, like on a daily basis, right, for more than 10 years.
Yeah, and it was almost an hourly basis because I have over 15,000 emails. We shot emails back and forth all the time as if it became the main way of communicating. He had a private system on AOL and I had a private system on AOL. And Steve Case, then in charge of AOL, made sure everything was copacetic. And when he became Secretary of State, we even had George Tenet, director of the CIA, come in and make sure everything was secure and that we could continue to communicate. We were the only ones that could communicate that way. Mm. We probably exchanged emails 30, 40, 50 times a day sometimes.
Wow. Over that time and that near constant contact and communication, I mean, there had to have been times where you thought, oh, maybe I'm not going to do this next year, but something changed your mind? Or was it just consistently like, this is now that I'm doing this job with this man, I'm going to do it for as long as he wants me to?
When he called me in July of 2002 to ask me to be his chief of staff when I was working for Richard Haass on the policy planning staff, I really had to think about it. And he knew I really had to think about it. First of all, he said to me, if you take this job, you can't stay here if Bush is not reelected. If you take this job, you're going to be a political appointee. You're going to be working for me. And when I leave, you have to leave. I said, are you planning on leaving anytime soon? Brief insight here for me. You never know, he said. I said, well, give me 24 hours to think about it. And that put me in a position where I knew that everything I was going to be doing from there on out was going to be for him, with him, and sometimes not necessarily in the open, because I knew what he wanted me to do was, first of all, protect him from the media as much as possible. Two, protect him from his enemies, who were all over the administration, and we were very cognizant of that by this time. And three, he was going to hope that I could help him with some real problems we'd identified in the Foreign Service and in the State Department in general. And I had to think about that. I had to think about it hard, because this was going to be what you were just implying. This was going to be a task that every day would make me wonder why I was there, why I stayed. It would make me talk to my wife on a number of occasions, telling her that I was leaving. I was leaving. And she would talk me out of it, because she would say, you know, you can't leave. You're the one person there who is totally dedicated to him. You can't leave. This came to a head over the 5 February presentation, the UN presentation. But it was a very different role I was playing after that, a far more personal and protective role for the Secretary of State. And yes, then it became very difficult. As a military officer, you do what you have to do, mm-hmm. as long as it's not disgustingly unethical or wrong. You do what you have to do, and there's a certain ethic that goes along with that. No, I'm not a military officer anymore. I'm a private citizen, and I'm working for a private citizen in a public position. It's a very different situation, I think. And as you implied, it was tough after that. Very tough.
Mm-hmm. Well, so particularly during that time, when he was Secretary of State, and you said that he had enemies all over the administration, can you tell me, can you describe to me how Colin Powell handled some of those toughest moments? I mean, in other words, when things got tough, what was he like? What did he do? What did he say?
That's a good question. And it's, answer, if I can even fashion a halfway good one, will reveal a lot about him. It was so bad by the third year that the Deputy Secretary of State, Rich Armitage, was calling the Vice President's office the Gestapo, the Nazis. Regularly, he would refer to them that way in my presence. And with that sort of thing going on, and with the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice, who had made up her mind that she was going to be the next Secretary of State, and therefore to ensure that she was not going to discipline the national security decision-making process the way she was supposed to, everyone seemed to be aligned against us. And so when you watched him operate, you knew he was operating against incredible odds. The president, the vice president, the national security advisor, and the secretary of defense, who was joined at the hip with the vice president, and who, for some ungodly reason, I've never been able to ferret or figure out, I think because he felt inferior, didn't like Powell, didn't like him at all, and wasted no opportunity here and there and elsewhere to indicate that by body language or by actual words. And with the vice president sort of backing him up in that regard, Powell was constantly confronted with the situation where not only was he losing the bureaucratic struggle, he was, and he knew it, losing the bigger struggle for the issue at hand, usually a fairly substantial issue. The only place where this did not occur, and which was really fascinating to watch, and no one's really covered this very well in the literature yet, was China. And he won the battles on China, as Rumsfeld and Cheney were ardently trying to create a new Cold War with China. Powell was keeping them from doing it. They were using fundamentally Taipei and Taiwan in general to do that. But Powell was very adroitly, bureaucratically and otherwise, maneuvering behind them in order to keep, at that time, Chen Shui-bian in Taipei from effecting a referendum for independence, which was a red line with Beijing. And it was wonderful to watch him every week do that. He would thwart them again and again and again. But I quickly ascertained why he was able to do that in the way that he was able to do it. Not only his own personal skill, bureaucratic and otherwise, and his contacts with China, which were good and solid. He had really gained their respect and their admiration. Bush was on his side. Bush knew the importance of the relationship with China to Walmart, to our economy. And he was not going to let Cheney and Rumsfeld, no matter how adroitly they maneuvered around him, and they tried it all the time, ruin that relationship. So he gave Powell his head on China. And that way, the most important strategic relationship America has in the world today and had then was handled very smoothly and very carefully and very wisely by Colin Powell and to a certain extent, George Bush. But the other issues, George Bush usually wound up being on Cheney and Rumsfeld's side. One time, Powell came back from a national security meeting and he said to me in a metaphor that I'll never forget, he said, "You know, LW, Cheney knows how to get the president to pull his 45 out and start shooting. And I just haven't figured out how to get him to put it back in its holster." And that was a brilliant metaphor for what was happening to him with regard to the vice president. Another example of how that worked. We were in talks with North Korea, very important talks with North Korea. The Assistant Secretary for East Asia and Pacific, Jim Kelly, was ready to go to Beijing and to sit down and consummate some fairly important aspects of those talks. And Powell had been able to, over Cheney's vehement protest, talk the president into blessing Jim Kelly's actually talking directly with the North Koreans. Therefore, we had had talk through the Chinese or through the Japanese or through some third party. It was idiotic. It was absolutely idiotic. But Cheney insisted that we didn't talk to evil. So how stupid is that? So we couldn't talk directly to the North Koreans. Well, Powell convinced the president to reverse that. Jim Kelly's headed for Beijing, and the president is in his Oval Office, and in goes Cheney, which happened so many times, all by himself. I think he'd come back from fly fishing in Wyoming, and he convinces the president to reverse his decision. And so we have to call Jim en route and tell him he's back in his straitjacket. He cannot talk to the North Koreans, not directly. He has to use the Chinese or some other interlocutor. This is how idiotic this situation was. And you had no national security advisor who was interested in changing that. And you had a president who, for the all practical purposes like those, was in the hands of a very Machiavellian vice president.
Mm. You know, in hearing all of this, Colonel Wilkerson, people have been wondering for decades now, why did Colin Powell not resign? Did he ever even think about it? Did the two of you ever talk about it? Because it does sound that frequently he was in a near impossible situation.
I think he gave it serious thought. It was not something he would share. It was something that he would cogitate on in his own mind, like so many of the fundamental things that affected him, and not share it with anyone other than perhaps Alma. And I knew it was in his mind because of what he said to me that day, that he might be leaving shortly, and that he loved saying to me, "I serve at the discretion of the president." Well, that meant that to me, I knew that that meant that maybe the president might get rid of him. I mean, after all, you've got Karl Rove, the political advisor to George W. Bush, whispering in George W.'s ear periodically that the most powerful political opponent he could confront in 2004 was his own Secretary of State. And you can be Powell and try to disabuse the president of any belief in that by saying, "I serve at the discretion of you and I will leave when you want me to leave. I have no political ambitions." And, you know, if you know anything about the political world, I know you do, no president's going to believe that. No president's going to slack his fear of a potential successful opponent when his great dream is to beat his own daddy and get reelected in 2004. And so that's infecting the relationship, too. Mm-hmm. Politics, you know, most Americans have no concept of this. Politics, domestic politics, makes as much impact, if not more, on national security decision-making, foreign policy decision-making, basic, fundamental, real issue decision-making as anything else. Domestic politics. I mean, why did Lyndon Johnson decide to go to 500,000 troops in Vietnam in 1965? Look at domestic politics for your answer. Mm.
In that period, especially that 2002 to 2005, or even 02 to 04, do you have a story of something Powell did or an experience you had with him that made you respect him even more?
Absolutely. A number of them. And there was the opposite of that, too. But to your question, his constant work to keep the U.S.-China relationship on an even keel was just impressive to watch. You may recall that in April of 2001, I believe it was, we had an incident in the South China Sea where a Chinese pilot of an F-8 fighter aircraft was doing his standard hoorah things, and he got a little bit close to the EP-3 that he was harassing, and he hit it. Hmm. It caused his death. His fighter plane crashed in the South China Sea, killing him. It caused the EP-3 reconnaissance plane enough damage to where it had to land an emergency landing on one of the most militarized places in all of China, and an island. That crisis was immediately exploited, or he tried to exploit it, by the vice president to do what I referred to earlier, make sure there was a Cold War going, and it was going at full speed ahead. Powell took over that crisis in a nanosecond. As I recall, he actually called on his cell phone to the Chinese Leadership Party, which was traveling in South America at that time, got one of the most able Chinese diplomats who knew America really well, Chen Qichen, on the phone. And within literally an hour or two, Powell had solved the crisis. And things were copacetic. The Chinese would apologize in English, and we would apologize in Chinese, and it would be disseminated to our various audiences. We would get our aircraft back, and things would go back to a reasonable relationship. So that was an incredible feat by him, for which he got little credit. Hmm. And watching him do that was watching a quintessentially superb diplomat and soldier do what he did. And I say that and soldier because he sent Joe Prewer, Admiral Joe Prewer, former ambassador to China, to be his representative for these little talks to iron out the crisis around all the wrinkles it had created. Interesting story there, too. The Chinese told Powell, through Prewer, that they would give the aircraft back if we would just, send appropriate people over to collect it. Well, Rumsfeld, in an effort to denigrate the Chinese, sent a Navy lieutenant. And so the Chinese chopped the aircraft back and sent it COD to the Pentagon.
Well, and you had also, you just said that also there may have been some times where, let me put it mildly, that you didn't agree with him or questioned his judgment.
Towards the end, he actually, first time in our experience together, told me to get out of his office. He actually looked at me and said, "Wipe that silly grin off your face, LW, and get out of my office." And it was a tense moment, but it was a moment caused by a number of factors that were building up to that moment. And the most notable in that list of factors was the presentation at the United Nations. We were not comfortable with one another after that. And the discomfort grew on my side to the point where I sometimes was a little acerbic in the advice I gave him or the comments I made. And he was picking up on that. And I think he knew. I know he knew the reason I was being that way. And it was grating at him, too. Every pillar in his presentation at the UN occasioned a call over that summer from someone, John McLaughlin, Tenet's deputy, or Tenet himself, or someone, essentially informing him that the latest pillar of his presentation had just collapsed, had just fallen apart, that there was no substance to it. The mobile biological labs were the last thing, as I recall, and Tenet actually called him on that. And he stormed into my office and he said, call up the CIA's website. Call it up. You'll see they've still got pictures of those labs on their website. God bless America. And he turned around and walked back into his office. He knew that we had done a dastardly deed, if you will. And he was very irritated about it. And he knew I was irritated about it as sort of the technical architect of putting it together. And so we had increasingly a difficult time. And then came the moment when, a terrible moment in both our lives. I had just been briefed by the chief of staff of the White House, Andy Card, and by our deputy chief of staff, the one who looked over the State Department, Brian Montgomery, that there would be a procedure, a very disciplined procedure for the election when it occurred and if Bush were reelected. And it involved everything from cabinet officers who wanted to resign would resign, but not all at once. Cabinet officers who wanted a different position or whatever would let it be known to the president and so forth. I briefed Powell on all of this. It was a very disciplined way of handling re-election. Well, the re-election came. Oh, by the way, when I walked into Rich's office, Rich Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State, after the election results were known, he was grumbling. And I said, Rich, what's the problem? And he said, we won. I said, didn't you want to win? And he said, hell no. I said, I want to get out of here. So that was sort of the atmosphere. But at any rate, here we are with this discipline replacement process, having been briefed and my briefing Powell on it. And all of a sudden, he gets a call from a functionary at the White House, a functionary telling him to submit his letter of resignation. He was so angry, we didn't see him for a week. Mm-hmm. Rich actually asked me if we should cut orders appointing him acting Secretary of State because we didn't have a Secretary of State. And then one morning after about a week, I noticed his elevator light come on and he was back in the building. It was very difficult to talk to him after that and very difficult for him to talk to me. It was a difficult time, very difficult time. And they treated him terribly, absolutely terribly. To top it all off, his out call on the President of the United States was scheduled for a certain day in January that got preempted because of the tsunami in Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And here's another story for you. I'm in London. I get a telephone call from the doyen of the ambassador corps, the ambassador from Singapore, who batted 10 miles above her weight. She was a brilliant woman. And she says to me, Larry, you have to get your boss. You have to get your boss to Indonesia. He's the only one they trust. I said, knowing she was absolutely correct, I said, thank you, Madam Ambassador. I called State Ops and they put him on the phone. And before I could say anything, he said, I've got my ticket. LW, I've got my ticket. I'm going to Aceh Province. And so he'd already, you know, he knew. Who was I to tell him what to do? So that postponed his out call on the president. Well, I'm getting calls all during the week prior to the new date for his out call. I think it was 11 January or something like that. And I'm telling them, you don't need talking points for the president. Finally, they said, yes, we do. I said, okay, talking point one, China. Talking point two, Japan. Talking point three, Russia. The president does not need to. Okay. So I knew that they knew when it was and where it was. Well, he goes for his out call on the president, and the president asks him, Colin, why are you here? I'm here for my out call on you, Mr. President. I'm leaving. And Bush goes, Andy, get in here. I'm referring to Andy Card, the chief of staff. Who did that? I don't know. Did Cheney do that? Was it just an error, a colossal error in protocol and in scheduling? But anyway, that's how badly they treated him towards the end. So I felt his angst and he felt my angst.
Wow. So to be clear for people who don't understand the protocol, is it that the president didn't know that?
He didn't know he was coming.
At all. But he knew. But he knew of his resignation, though.
Well, I don't even know that. I assume he did. And maybe the president was playing them all for fools. Who knows?
Wow.
Having met the president on a number of occasions, and on one occasion spending some 30 minutes with him in his office, Oval Office, I understood he was a lot smarter than he seemed to be on television.
Well, Colonel Wilkerson, you yourself have mentioned Secretary Powell's speech to the United Nations on the 5th of February, 2003. We need to talk about that a little bit more. And you were his chief of staff at that time. Can you describe to me what your role in the crafting and presentation of that speech was?
Sure. He walked into my office in late January of 2003, and he said, throwing a script down on my desk of about 48 pages or so, he said, "This is the script I'll use to present at the United Nations on 5 February to advance the case of Iraq's having weapons of mass destruction." I sat down in his presence. I normally don't sit down in the secretary's presence, even though I've known him for a long time. I sat down in my chair and I said, "Are you kidding me, sir?" And he said, "Nope, you're going to have to do it." Now, he'd stuck me with these kinds of missions lots of times in my life. And I'd always try to do the best I could. He stuck me with his retirement from the chairmanship, which was an incredible gala affair. And if I hadn't had the whole joint staff to help me, I probably would have fallen on my face. But this one was beyond the pale as far as I was concerned. What I became, because I did not resign, I wrote out my resignation, put it in my center drawer, and, "Dear Mr. President, blah, 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 I resign." I didn't submit it because I called my wife and she told me, "You got to stay with him. You got to stay with him. These are really dark times. You got to stay with him." So I put it in my center drawer. And I assembled a team. And our purpose was to put together the most powerful, effective, technically and otherwise, presentation we could to convince the UN Security Council, if possible, the international community, if possible, and most importantly, a majority of the American people, that there was a valid reason for this war that was looming on the horizon. I was presented with Mr. Tenet, Mr. McLaughlin, Robert Walpole, and Larry Gershwin. The last two were analysts at the CIA. And I should have been wary immediately because they were the only people I was presented with. No one else was allowed to get to me or to get to Powell. And for 5 or 6 days and nights, we didn't sleep hardly. We got the White House, finally got the White House technical team under Scott Sforza, because the CIA did not have the capability to do a first-class presentation. And then the Challenger went down, as I recall, in Houston on the 1st of February, or in space, run out of Houston. And they stole that team from me. And so I had to make Condi Rice aware of that so that she would give me the team back if possible. She did. And this is what I did. I orchestrated the logistics and the technical aspects of that presentation.
The technical aspects, meaning the intelligence that was presented?
No, Okay. Meaning when Powell said, "I want that NSA intercept, I want that NSA intercept, I want that piece of material intelligence, I want that piece of signals intelligence," or whatever, I then did things like, for the NSA intercepts, coordinate the translation from Arabic or Farsi or Urdu or whatever they were in into English and do multiple translations in separate spaces so that I could then check them to make sure that they were indeed accurate translations or as accurate as possible of the Farsi, Arabic, Urdu, or whatever into English, and then synchronize them with the Urdu, Arabic, or whatever text on the screen and make sure the English came across understandable for the majority of the audience that would be watching. Those kinds of things were what we had to do. I also pored over satellite photography in the basement of the Pentagon until I was blind. We actually did something that probably few people in America have ever achieved. We actually moved satellites because it's so expensive to move them, and took subsequent looks at places that I said we needed to look at again. It perplexed me that Saddam Hussein was doing what he was doing because he was giving us all the signatures that were necessary to determine that a particular point, ammunition supply point in most cases, had chemical weapons or biological weapons. To this day, I don't know why he was doing that unless he was afraid if he didn't do it, if he didn't convince the United States that he still had them, he couldn't convince his enemies that he still had them, to include his own people. And so he was playing this very dangerous game of knowing how we leaked like a sieve, and he was showing us things on the ground through our satellites that were not actually accurate, but they were spoofing us, in other words, like the North Koreans did, for example, with their basketball court that we said was a rocket engine test bed until we saw a bunch of soldiers out there playing basketball on it. Now, most of the countries in the world know our satellite capabilities and use them to spoof us and to fool us sometimes if they're very sophisticated. So I had to do all these things in 5 days and five nights and get this presentation ready for roughly an hour, 25 minutes in front of the UN Security Council. That was my job.
Were there debates, though, or disputes at the time before Secretary Powell gave his speech on the 5th of February about the reliability of the information that you're talking about?
Absolutely. One of the most dramatic was when he actually accosted me physically. He'd never done that before. He grabbed me, as we say in the military, by the stacking swivel, my shirt, my coat. And he shoved me into a room in the National Intelligence Council spaces, slammed the door shut, sat me down in a chair and said, "I guess we're private here." And I said, trying to make some humor, "It is the CIA, boss." He was not amused. He said, "I am sick and tired of this crap." He didn't use the word crap. It was a little rougher than that. On terrorism and terrorists. I'm not going to present it. I refuse to present this stuff. I think he thought I was going to object. I looked at him. I'd been in the rehearsals enough to know how he felt about it and how I felt about it. I looked at him and I said, "Good, boss, we'll throw it out." He looked at me and he said, "You agree?" I said, "Absolutely. Let's throw it out. It stinks." So I also knew that was probably going to be the most powerful part with the American people, connecting Saddam Hussein with Al-Qaeda. So I went to Lynn Davidson, who is the writer. She was putting it together at the computer. And I said, "Lynn, we're going to take all this out." She was happy. She thought it stunk, too. So we start going through it. I didn't see John McLaughlin, the deputy DCI, CIA head, leaning against the door, the true devil at the CIA. John McLaughlin disappeared then. He disappeared with Tenet, I'm absolutely certain, because we go back into the rehearsal. We resume the rehearsal about 30 minutes, 40 minutes later, and Powell is going through a rather perfunctory rehearsal because we're not too far down the road at this point. And all of a sudden, Tenet gets up and leaves, and I'm sitting beside Powell. Tenet was on his right. I was on his left. And I'm thinking, where is George going at this important moment? And I got my answer about 15, 20 minutes later. He comes back in and he sits down beside Powell. And this is a direct quote, as my memory will allow me to quote it. "We've just learned from a high-level Al-Qaeda operatives interrogation of significant contacts between al-Qaeda and the Mukhabarat, the Iraqi secret police, to include the Mukhabarat training al-Qaeda operatives in the use of chemical and biological weapons. End of quote. Powell turns to me and says, LW, put it back in. And we did. We put all that back in. Subsequently, much later, I learned that this was Sheikh al-Libi, that he was tortured in Egypt, that no U.S. intelligence personnel were present during the torture, and that indeed al-Libi himself recanted a week or two afterwards, saying he would have said anything to stop the torture. Fast forward, al-Libi is murdered in Libyan prison later on. Don't ask me why. But this changed everything. It changed everything in terms of that presentation's impact on the American people, because go back and watch it. Powell says Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda are connected. And in a time of 9/11, you know, implying that Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda knew all about 9/11 and Saddam Hussein was supportive. This was the most powerful part of the presentation. It was based on a lie that George Tenet communicated to Powell in front of my face. Later, I would find out from other CIA operatives who were cognizant of what had happened that that was indeed the case. It was a bald-faced lie. They knew. The DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, put out a burn notice on al-Libi's testimony within 2 weeks of his having recanted. But Tenet never showed us that burn notice. And when I later asked George why, he said it was a computer glitch. Come on, George. A computer glitch? You didn't show the Secretary of State information that would have made him throw out that part of his testimony for sure. I mean, he'd already thrown it out. You got him to put it back in. This is what happened. These sorts of things happened again and again and again.
Before the 5th of February, 2003, did Secretary of State Colin Powell think the United States should invade Iraq, go to war with Iraq?
I don't think so. Based on the conversations that I'd had with him, no. He did think that if there were occasion for Saddam to do something again that threatened one of his neighbors, or perhaps even was so heinous, like his gassing of his own people, that it needed to be dealt with military force, the occasion might arise where we'd want to do it. But the occasion wasn't there. And there were so many reasons the occasion wasn't there. He gave many of them to the president in the hour, hour and a half presentation he gave the president. One of them he knew very well, as did I, because of what we'd done when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs. We had, under President H.W. Bush and then Clinton, even more so, cut the military. We'd cut it dramatically, over 25, 26%. We had cut the military. And he knew that you could not do the war in Afghanistan and invade Iraq. You couldn't. You would take your eye off the ball in Afghanistan. It would become, in military terms, an economy of force theater, and it would go to pot, as it well did. The Taliban resurgent, the Taliban back, and we're fighting a whole new war. He knew that. And so he used that military expertise to advise the president, even though the vice president had told him repeatedly, don't be talking like your chairman anymore. You're Secretary of State now. You're not chairman anymore. So he is defying the vice president in that regard. But that was one of the most important reasons that he, as a military professional, knew that we shouldn't be doing another war, and we damn sure shouldn't be doing it when we didn't actually need to at the time. Mm-hmm. Now, over the subsequent months and weeks and time after his presentation, he rationalized it more and more, and I think wound up trying to believe that there was a reason to go to war with Saddam Hussein to get rid of him, even if there weren't any WMD, because he was a malevolent individual and sooner or later would have probably done something that we'd had to react to. I think that was more rationalization than anything else.
Yeah. You know, Colonel Wilkerson, back in 2006, you gave an interview on PBS. And in that interview, you said that your participation in the February UN presentation constituted the lowest point of your professional life, that you participated in a hoax on the American people, the international community, and the UN Security Council. In the months after February 5th, 2003, when the truth of the unreliability of the intelligence that UN Secretary Powell were given, how did Powell himself look back on that speech? What did he tell you about how he felt about having done it?
We never talked about it. He wouldn't talk about it with me. It was, as I said before, it was that issue between us at the end that, I mean, I'm standing there when he's giving me an award at the end of his time as Secretary of State and my time as his Chief of Staff. And it's all I can do to even stand there and hold the award in my hand, and all I think he could do to be there beside me, understanding what we did about how things had come to just a bottomless pit at the end of the 4 years. It was so difficult. We couldn't talk about it. We exchanged some views about the particulars, you know, like I was talking about with Tenet telling him that the last pillar of his presentation had collapsed with the mobile biological labs. But in terms of talking about it in general, it was just too hard. It was too hard for us to discuss it, and especially for him, I think.
This is the great tragedy, right? I mean, because I think Secretary Powell himself later on at one time was quoted as saying he knows that that speech is going to be in his obituary. And for a man who served his country at the level and with the dedication that General and Secretary Powell did, I mean, what does it make you feel that one day, that one speech is such a central part of his public biography now?
It's the way we do things in America. It's the way we do things in general. And it's certainly the way we do things these days. A whole life of honor and dignity and good works and capability and so forth can be ruined by a single mistake that gets essentially the media frenzy, if you will, that such mistakes get and doesn't die down, stays there and haunts you. And haunts you in particular if you are somewhat aware of the avenues you could have taken perhaps to escape it and didn't take. That, and one of those now is not having resigned and prevent the war. That was absolute nonsense. We both knew that if he resigned, Condi would come in and we'd go to war anyway, or someone would come in and we'd go to war anyway. They were intent on having their war, and Colin Powell's resignation, the flames from it would have lasted about a week, and then bang, we'd have gone right on to war. So that wasn't something that I think haunted him. It's certainly not something that haunted me, because it was just reality. But the rationalization that if I'm not here, then the person who replaces me will not be as dedicated to preventing bad things from happening as I am is there. It's always there. Yeah. And it catches you and keeps you from doing what everyone afterwards, in perfect hindsight, says you should have done, resign your office. I was thinking about that the other day when General Milley was testifying on Afghanistan in the Congress, and Senator Stentorian Senator Tom Cotton asked him said, why haven't you resigned, or something to that effect. And had I been Milley, here's what I would have said back to Senator Cotton. Why haven't you? Because the most egregiously responsible entity in the American government for the past 20 years of stupid, endless war is the Congress of the United States, who have surrendered the constitutional war power to the executive branch and don't want it back, don't want to touch it. It's too contaminative, so they don't want it back. That's the kind of that's what I was referring to when I quoted that from the cover of John le Carré's book, Silverview. How do you remain patriotic to a country you no longer recognize? Powell, as reluctant as he might have been, came at the end to appreciate the validity of that sentiment. I appreciated it long before he, much to my chagrin and my sadness, that it's not the same country. It's a different country. It's a country whose raison d'etre, reason for existing, is to make war on other countries. It's a country whose military-industrial complex makes so much money off war that it perpetuates that war. And did he come late to that realization? Of course he did. He came up through that hierarchy, and it put him in the highest office in the land, save one. It put him in the highest office in the land, in the military, the most powerful military in the world. And he was a black man. He did all that. How could he then say, I doubt the process through which I ascended? He couldn't. Humanly impossible. But I know he had his doubts at the end.
What do you think the American people don't know or don't understand about the Colin Powell that you knew?
What a warm, loving, caring individual he was. A friend of mine who left his employ in an office with me when he was chairman and went to be vice president of downstream communications for Royal Dutch Shell and then went to Boeing and other places, sent me a note the other day attached to an email. It was a note Powell had sent to me, LW, and I had given to him so he could read it too. And it was George Marshall's words about subordinates. You know, your subordinates need morale. Enlisted men and women need morale. They need you to look after their morale. I don't expect officers to have morale. Officers, no one's looking after my morale, said George Marshall in the note. That was Powell. It wasn't him in terms of his fellow officers. He looked after them too, but he was not that austere, not as George Marshall apparently was. But he did feel like he owed the major portion of his attention to his subordinates and to those less fortunate than he. That's why he devoted so much of his time to the D.C. school system, for example, or to kids in general, to Boys and Girls Clubs across America and so forth. He really loved young people and loved helping young people. People don't remember that about him, except those like me who were close to him and knew him so well. But he was incredible in that regard. One time, story here, one time he was monitoring what I was doing with the Colin Powell Leadership Club at this McFarland Middle School in Washington, D.C. Washington Post came out there and did a spread on it for the style section and everything. But Powell was monitoring it from the point of view of, could he help me in any way at all, other than money and things like that? And I said, yeah, I need speakers. He said, okay. Next thing I know, Henry Kissinger is standing in front of my 10 to 14-year-olds lecturing them on what it was like to work for Richard Nixon. In the middle of the lecture, one of my more obstreperous 12-year-olds, little boy, was waving his hand back and forth. Unperturbed, Kissinger looked at him and said, yes. And then the boy said, cut to the chase. What was it like working for Tricky Dick? And Kissinger didn't miss a beat. He went on to tell them initially, he said, well, you know, we didn't like each other. He didn't like me and I didn't like him. And it got better from there. That was Powell. You know, we're all sitting there laughing. The principal who had come into the room, of course, because Henry Kissinger was there, was looking appalled. Oh, my God, Tyrone, what did you say? But that was Powell. And on another occasion, I told him the lockers in the school really badly needed painting and revamping. And so he said, well, get some people and let's do it. So I got the 8th and I Marines, the equivalent of the old guard, the 3rd Infantry in the Army. I got the 8th and I Marines to come over. And here we are with 40 Marines, and we're painting these lockers and we're scraping them and everything else, straightening out the metal and putting new locks on them and everything else. And what does he do? He shows up in his, you know, $1,800 suit, and he's walking amongst these Marines who are covered with paint and everything else, and he's shaking their hands, and he's thanking them for being there and all this. That was Colin Powell.
Wow. I guess my last question for you, Colonel, is what impact did Colin Powell have on you, on your life?
Changed my life completely. Absolutely. Changed my life completely. I feel like I had the opportunity to work for a Black Eisenhower, or for that matter, for a Black George Washington, which is really a stretch of the imagination, if you will. I knew that there were people who whispered behind his back that it was his blackness that got him to where he was. But I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that that was false, that maybe from time to time there were affirmative action type things that occurred, mostly because people were anxious to put someone who was truly competent in a position of high responsibility to show that they cared about race relations and so forth. If there was anything untoward about that sort of thing around Powell, basically he was the most competent military officer and the most caring and empathetic with a brilliant sense of humor individual I ever met. If he had one flaw that I would point out and say it almost was his undoing, it was his naivete. He thought other people, until they proved otherwise, were as decent as he, as honest as he, as competent as he, at least to the point where he could work with them. And it was often not the case, and it was late that he realized that, and it got him in trouble from time to time. And interestingly, when I first went to work for him, I met with a young lady from Nevada, Mary Bell Thatcher, who had been with him for a while. And I was asking her questions about him because I didn't know him at all. And she said, "There's one thing I would warn you about. Beware of his naivete." And I said, "What do you mean, Mary Bell?" And she said, "Well, sometimes about other people who are around him, he can be terribly naive." I found that was true. And if he had a seminal weakness, I don't know if that's the right word, weakness for that, it was that he wanted to believe other people were as dedicated to the role they were in a sense of decency, competence, and so forth, as he was. And it was often not the case.
Is there anything else that you want to say about him? Any other questions? There's a billion questions I probably should have asked, but.
Well, you know, USA Today asked me to write an op-ed, and other than you, that's the only thing I've done. And I realized as I submitted it yesterday that they probably won't print it, because I tried to say what I was so inarticulate in trying to get across to you. And that is that, if you are a Black man and you have risen to the pinnacle of power in your country, and you know all that that means as a Black man, as well as a military officer and later a diplomat, and you have convinced yourself, and you constantly talk about to young people and others as if it were your sole message to them of consequence, that if you do what I have done, you too will realize the dream. And then suddenly come to the end and don't recognize that dream anymore. Horrible. I mean, for a man like him, horrible. For a man like me, it's horrible. But for a man like him, double so.
In terms of the failures of the nation now?
Yes. Yes. He was so confident, for example, that the military, as a social entity, if you will, had solved the race problem, that he was an exemplar of that, that others were and were coming up. And then all of a sudden he looked around and he saw the promotion boards no longer putting Black officers forward. And Chuck Hagel called him and said, "What's happening, Colin? What's happening? These officers who are coming over here to talk to me, they're idiots. I wouldn't put a single one of them in charge of a service or in charge of a unified command, let alone make them chairman of the Joint Chiefs. What's wrong? What's happened, Colin?" Well, you can't have that sort of thing occurring around you and not begin to realize, even if you're somewhat naive, that it's not the same republic. It's not even a republic.
Well, retired Colonel Larry Wilkerson, Thank you so much for sharing your time, your memories, and your insights into Colin Powell. Thank you so much.
Thank you for allowing me, Magna. Thank you very much.
Well, that was our entire unedited interview with retired Colonel Larry Wilkerson. Over the course of 12 years, he served as the late Colin Powell's special assistant at the Joint Chiefs and as Powell's chief of staff at the State Department. Wilkerson is a 31-year veteran of the U.S. Army, and he's currently at the Eisenhower Media Network. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.